Everyone, welcome to the next episode of What's New in Adapted Physical Education. I am Amanda Young, Assistant Professor of PEAT and APE at Long Beach State, and I am joined by one of our Project CAPE scholars, Paul Kim. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Dr. Young. How are you?
Great, thank you. So Paul completed his undergraduate studies in physical education, teacher education with an APE added authorization here at Cal State Long Beach. He also received his teaching credential from CSULB and is currently in his fourth year teaching as an APE specialist for charter schools in the LA and Orange County area. This is his first semester as a Project CAPE scholar, so he's one of our master's scholars, and we are excited to have him join us. Paul, you want to say a quick little hello introduction?
Hi, everyone. My name is Paul, and like Dr. Young just introduced me, I'm an APE specialist working for charter schools in LA, and I'm excited to be here and to have this conversation with Brittany, and looking forward to it.
Great. Thanks, Paul. So through the U.S. Department of Ed OSEP grant, we at Cal State Long Beach are able to record these episodes with APE professionals for our master's scholars and for everyone to listen to. We would like to recognize the impact these experts have on the field of APE and thank them for their continued support in training the next generation of APE specialists. So with that, I will introduce Brittany Finumiai. Brittany, thanks for being on here. Brittany is a PE teacher in her seventh year at the Baird School through Howard Center in Burlington, Vermont, which is an alternative school that provides special education, therapeutic intervention, and treatment to students in grades K through 8. Brittany is originally from Alaska, and she did her undergraduate work in physical education at Northern Arizona University. She's also a fellow OSEP scholar who completed her master's in APE from Texas Women's University. And then Brittany moved to Vermont in 2017 and has been in the Green Mountain State ever since. Welcome, Brittany. We're so glad to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Great. So Brittany, can you tell us a little bit more about your PE position?
Yeah, so I've been at the school, like you said, for 7 years. I truly didn't know what to expect when I first started. I just applied for jobs all over the country after grad school in Texas at TW and landed one in Burlington, and I've been here since. It is a small school. I have about 50 students. It's a multi-grade classroom classes. K through two, third, fourth, three, four to six, and then five, six, six, seven, seven, eight. So I have students that come from all over the state of Vermont.
In a very specialized school, and we'll get into that in a little bit. When I first asked Brittany to come on this podcast, my goal was for her to share her experience with specifically to behavior management for my students taking my behavior management class. I think her expertise and the student population is highly specialized, and we need to know more about that. So the majority of students on Brittany's caseload are students with EBD. And so I think it's really important for us to kind of get into that population because it's different than most APE caseloads. And I think something that we all should learn a little bit more about. And when we first started talking about this, Brittany mentioned that she wished she'd learned more about the EBD population in her graduate studies. And Paul is really interested in behavior management as well. So I think this is a great conversation for us to have and share with the rest of the APE world. So let's jump into the questions. Paul, take it away.
Yeah, so I have a couple lists of questions that I prepared today. But for those that might not be familiar, do you mind kind of explaining like the acronyms EBD and what kind of population that it might entail?
Yeah, so EBD stands for Emotional Disturbance or Behavior Disorder. It is recognized one of the categories under IDEA for special education, but isn't typically thought about, like Dr. Young said, in the APE world. We think a lot of physical, cognitive, intellectual disabilities when it comes to APE. And EBD is one of those where, you know, it's not observable for the most part. And right. It's all hidden gem. So, yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. And what would you say are some like common misconceptions about the population of students that you work with?
Oh boy. This was a tough question when I looked at it because I've never worked at a public school except with student teaching or really in the APE field except with my work I did at TWU in my graduate program. And so I was like, man, how do I compare these students to typically developing or students who might be on a typical APE caseload? And I think I was overthinking it, and they're just kids. Like a lot of times people look at them or these students and like try to quote unquote fix them or like control their behaviors. And that's almost like the complete opposite of what you want to do when it comes to students on the EB, D, diagnoses and being able to like, they're just kids. They want to have fun. They want to learn. They want to be treated like humans and not like their experiences. So.
Right. I think that is really true in all of the students is that they are kids after all, and they want to have fun and engage with others through physical education.
Right.
So I'm glad that that you said that, and that hopefully those misconceptions will slowly kind of go away with further discussion and just knowing more about the population as well, is because we might not get in contact with them as much. So thank you for that answer. In terms of supports for these students, what are some supports that you have at your schools at the micro level or in the macro level to help support them in their classrooms and in the PE classroom specifically.
So in general, my school's actually very, it's a niche, it's very specialized. We are in a mental health organization, so we aren't actually a part of the public school system in the state of Vermont. Our students, similar to APE World, they get referrals, and then we have clinicians who go and do observations, our clinical director and such, and see if our program is a good fit or our school is a good fit for them. So that's first and foremost. But in the school in general, we have six classroom clinicians, two certified behavior specialists, a clinical director. There's five special education teachers, and then six classroom teachers. And within each classroom, there is a behavior interventionist, which is similar to a paraeducator, somebody who might be supporting somebody or a student who has an IEP. But their main focus is to help with behaviors and be proactive in the classroom so learning can happen. You know, they teach us in school that learning can't happen if students aren't at baseline, and that's so true. And like, this is the population that especially like needs that, or like the baseline's different every day, so flexibility is super important. But yeah, in PE, I have one other adult with me, whether it's the classroom teacher or the behavior interventionist for the classroom. I provide a meal break for either or the other person. And so it's rather interesting. I have a big space and my classes are very small. Actually, I could have my smallest class right now is seven students and my biggest class is nine. But I could have anywhere from zero kids or one kid to all nine just based on the day and if they're in a behavior in crisis. So it's a little tricky planning planning content or like objectives and standards and activities for this population. And it's very unpredictable, which I find very enjoyable in this line of work. So,
Yeah, and you said it was a multi-grade or classroom.
I have 1K to 2 class, and then like a 3-4 class, 4-5 class. And then our middle school side of the hallway can be anywhere from 5-7, 6-7, 7-8.
Okay, so you never know what you're gonna get, who's gonna come, who's not, who's gonna be in different moods, and so that is quite interesting, and that that sounds fun. And just to kind of I know you talked a little bit about the process of referrals and assessment, and so how does the transition process? Can you walk us through the transition process of a student possibly coming from a public school or wherever school that may be, and if they determine that that your school is more of a right fit for the student. How does that transition happen, and what are some steps that parents and the school takes?
Yeah, so I only know a little bit about this process. I'm not involved in the transition process from public school to my school. But there is a referral from a public school, whether it is the special education team, classroom teacher, parents, et cetera. Whoever is on that student's team will make the referral. We will have our clinical director and a clinician, usually, or an admin member, go and observe the student in the general milieu from their public sending school. And then they kind of either it's a, I don't know if it's an informal observation or if there's a formal observation or assessment that's done, but we talk with the team to figure out if this is the least restrictive environment for them where they can be successful. And from there, students join our school or don't. Sometimes, they need a little bit more support than what we're able to provide them. So, yeah.
And so are the students that do get referred to your school, are they like students with significant behavioral needs, or what
Yes.
does that
So,
look like?
yes and no. I think that is dependent on the person and experience. What I might deem a significant behavior might be very different than somebody in the public school
True.
system. So our students, I can have students who are brand new and might be in a honeymoon phase, and you're like, wow, why is a student at my school? And then honeymoon phase is over, and lo and behold, you see these behaviors, like, oh, this makes sense. Behaviors look like physical aggression, verbal aggression, object aggression towards peers, staff members, et cetera. So, and every student, has a different trigger or whatever it might escalate them and et cetera. So it's very important that you build that relationship and rapport with the student from day one to understand them.
For sure.
Yeah. And then you mentioned how we have different phases of meeting the student, and then having the honeymoon phase, and then displaying some behaviors that might not be appropriate. And maybe they come around and they work on and improve on those behaviors, or decreasing unwanted behaviors. So do you have any success stories where you had those challenging behaviors, but you were able to through whatever methods or through your teachings, how are you can you share some success stories that you had in the past?
Yeah, I was trying to think of like one specific scenario or story, but truly every day can be a success story at my school. It could be something as small as the day before, say something triggered that student and their baseline was, very high already and their tolerance for stress was very low. Something that might have triggered them, and then the next day they come in and the same situation happens. They're able to use their coping skills to regulate themselves, whether it's self-regulation, co-regulation, or just not have as big of a reaction or escalation to that trigger. Like that's just a win in itself, and building that consistency of structure and implementation of behavior plans, making sure everybody's on the same page is key at our school or the school I work at.
And really, you mentioned the behavior intervention plan for BIPs. So, on average, how many of the students that do have a BIP? Is it mostly all of them, or do they have one coming in, or do you develop one at the school? And yeah, I just wanted to know about the behavior intervention plan
Yeah.
for students.
So I don't write any ICMPs or BIPs or anything, behavior management plans. That is left up to the clinician, since we do have clinicians in-house, whether they're social workers or mental health clinicians. They write most of those behavior plans. I don't know the exact number, but I do know a good majority of our students have them, whether they are indefinite plans that are written and the whole team knows about, or if it's just the classroom team who has some sort of, incentive or reward system to be able to build momentum with a student. So whether it's a small scale or a large scale, almost every single one of our students does have a behavior plan of some sort.
And you said that there are multiple BIs and probably like BC BAs that are in-house. So how often do you get to collaborate with them? Is it on the daily, or do you have monthly meetings to kind of check in with certain behaviors that they're targeting? Or yeah, tell us about because I think that your school is very unique in that sense that you have a lot of hands-on collaboration, but also all those professionals within the school. So yeah, let's know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so we're really fortunate to, we call it like a 4.5 day school week because our students come to school Monday through Friday full time from 8:10 is when school starts to 2:30 at dismissals. And then Friday, we have a half day every Friday. And after the students leave, our classroom-based teams or interdisciplinary teams, we change the terminology, but basically, the classroom team, whether it's a teacher, the BI, the intensive BI, the clinician, admin, whether it's a special education director, the education director, the clinical director, whoever it is, and we need, they meet once every 2 weeks on Fridays, and you get about an hour and a half. So, the way we've structured these meetings this year is really new to us. It used to be the administrator would run the meeting, and they're really trying to focus on classroom teachers and the team that works with the students on a day-to-day basis be in charge of that. Like, what's working in your classroom? What's not? What do you need support with? Where might you need more clinical support or, behavior support or ideas for a classroom contingency plan? All sorts of things. So that happens once every 2 weeks. But clinicians, I know, meet once a week, and they have clinical support group. And then I bounce around to every team. So I'm fortunate to know every student, and that's what I love about my job. But that can also have its downside of being able to go to every meeting, be where you need to be, and discuss things that might be like problems or areas to work on in class, where there's a student, behavior management, et cetera.
Great points. Yeah, I think that's so important that we remember that we do have to be part of the team, but then it's really challenging to be able to be part of every single team because you are you, I'm guessing you're the only PE teacher at this school.
Yeah. And I think back, to APE and like how I was, what I thought the type of teacher I was going to be in regards to being itinerant or at a school district and like or at one school or be a contracted worker. I could not imagine being on so many different teams and having so many responsibilities. And like, truthfully, I don't do any paperwork and I am like,
Bonus,
yeah.
bonus.
But collaborating, it's a blessing and a curse being able to have so many people to collaborate with. But at the same time, it can be hard to collaborate with so many people because we are such a tight-knit small community of a school, that it can be tricky sometimes.
For sure. I think
Yeah.
that's also a nice thing because you get the students from when they start throughout their schooling there. So I think that's how it
Yeah.
was at my school as well. I had them for, first through sixth grade, and it was really nice to be able to grow with them and be able to see, like you said, those small successes every day. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. Obviously, the goal is for students to go back to public school or their general milieu or sending school, whether it is with, we have another program through Howard Center. It's a school services program called Inclusion. So we send a BI with the student back into the school, whether they are in their in-house behavior program or are in the general milieu. That BI will kind of bounce around with them class to class and just help offer that support. They know that student, they know their behavior plan, they're able to intervene or see signs of potential distress and whatnot and proactively engage and help them out, but also like give them that little bit of independence. Like, hey, I'm here if you need me. But if I see that you're having an off day, maybe like your lid is flipped already, like I'm gonna step in to help you be successful. So it's pretty, yeah.
And now, really quick, so you mentioned a lot about proactive behavior management, and I think that's really important for our students. Can you talk about what that looks like in your PE setting? Like, what kind of proactive steps do you take to ensure success and safety for your students?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is A, knowing my students and building those relationships. I've had a lot of the same students since I've been there from since 2017, which is great. You know, also a bummer because we want them to be able to build those skills and go back. But just seeing the growth from when they started to now is awesome. But it's understanding the class too and the dynamics, the social setting of where students are at. Like one day students can be best friends, and the next day they could absolutely hate each other, you know, and are we I if I had to guess, we're seeing it a lot in schools across the country, like social emotional, or you know, that's a really high hitting topic point, whether it's in special education, you know, general milieu, whatever it is, and understanding and having the communication with the team in the morning, like, hey, how's this going? This is my plan for the day. And the teacher might, we use texting a lot every day. Like that's how we communicate, is we're on our phones in WhatsApp. We have strands, and we're able to communicate with BIs, classroom teachers, clinicians, admin, etc. Like, hey, this is what I'm thinking today for teams, or this is what I'm thinking today for activity, whatever unit I'm doing and it's related to. What do you think? You know, like I ask a lot of input. I do have a lot of autonomy and in what I want to do and choose to do, which is fantastic. But being able to lean on my coworkers and colleagues to figure out what's going to be the most successful for my students is fantastic.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I think I answered your question. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah,
No.
definitely.
I think, yeah, communication is really important within classroom teacher as well, is because as APE teachers, we only see them for a very short amount of time, like relative
Yeah.
to some teachers where they are there all day, and we might not understand the kind of the macro level in terms of, like you said, social dynamics with inside the classroom, and it's not always the same, and it's constantly changing. For example, even today in one of my classrooms, it was a middle school student, and they were in a group of three, and the three that I thought that they were always going to be friends, there was some drama, and she actually asked to join another group,
Goodness.
and it was just interesting to see that, for a seventh grade girl, that it's always not. It's like plastic. It can change any moment. So that just came into my mind that we really do need to understand this and respect the student's social and emotional state in PE and in the classroom as well.
Yeah, and I think if there's one thing that I've learned the most working at this school is the comfort versus control aspect of teaching, or just behavior management, right? Like, I, as a teacher, want my classroom to be as safe as possible to have this learning environment where people are successful, they feel safe, they feel welcomed, etc. But just because one student might be having a behavior and is you know, off doing their own thing, whether it's throwing equipment, whatnot. Like, I'm going to focus on these five kids who are doing the right thing. Not to say that student isn't important, but I'm going to give that student some time and space to cool off. And then my relationship with them will allow me to go check, hey, but like, what's going on? What do you need? And they might be like, I hate blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, like, did something happen? Like, being able to talk it out with them and through them, rather than trying to control that student in the moment, be like, hey, you're not allowed to do that. You're not supposed to be doing that. Like, allowing students to have their time and space, just like adults, you know, like when we're not emotionally regulated, we struggle to communicate our needs. And these students especially have difficulty expressing or communicating their needs and what they want, whether it's previous experiences doing so, or they never had the opportunity to. So allowing them that safe space to be able to do what they need to do in a safe manner, obviously, but also respecting, like, I'm gonna comfort you. I'm gonna give you what you need right now, and then when it's time for us to meet and figure this out together, we can do that. So I think that's a
I
huge.
love that. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I think that's so important that a lot of times adults want to correct. And, you know, that's all well and good if it's appropriate at the time, but sometimes that's not necessarily appropriate for these kiddos. Like, we got to give them the space. And
Yeah,
then
like
also give your attention to the kiddos that want that attention and that are deserving of that attention.
And there's so many layers too. Like a lot of students that I work with, from my experience, do want that attention and like will do maladaptive behaviors to get your attention. And
Oh,
so
yeah.
being just like, anything, just like to be like, oh, well, like you're gonna do that. I'm gonna talk to these kids, not to punish you, but when you're on track, then I'm gonna be able to give you my attention. Like that's just a natural consequence of it. I'm not taking something away from you. It's not a punishment. It's just that's just the reality. It's a life skill, a transferable
For
life skill.
sure.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
Awesome. Yeah. Brittany, you mentioned the comfort of the students before they are able to learn and to work on their skills. And is there other kind of words or any other things that like tips for success during the class that you would like to share for us? I know you mentioned being proactive, like before the lesson, about like communicating with the classroom teacher about anything that might be of importance. But during the lesson, during the actual PE time, APE time, yeah, what are some things, yeah, tips for success or rules to live by that you found
Oh, yeah.
successful?
Humor, flexibility, connection, openness. And also, I think as adults in school settings, from my experience and also being a student and a teacher, being able to admit that like you made a mistake over something, kids these days, I feel like, regardless of their upbringing or where they came from, are so afraid to make mistakes because of social settings, whether it's peers or they want to like impress or look to their teachers like, hey, am I doing this right? Like get that validation and affirmation and reassurance. So
Right.
if I make a mistake in class, I'm like, oh, I made a mistake. I actually meant this. So sorry. Does anybody have any questions? And they're able to see me be vulnerable in that moment and know that like the only way we learn is if we make mistakes. So being able to understand that and show them like, hey, I made a mistake. I should have done this instead. And like finding humor in like little small things. And I think it all again comes through the connections you have with your students. Like I wouldn't be able to find humor in things that a lot of people wouldn't, or I would not be able to find the humor in things at my school. Most people I think wouldn't be able to, but because I know my students and understand them to the best of my ability, like I am able to.
Yeah, I totally agree on all of them, and humor is one of them. And sometimes my students might not like it, but I try to make jokes and I feel like I'm funny. But
Not being afraid to like embarrass yourself as a teacher either. Like I think it comes down to too, like I said, making mistakes or like failing, like being silly, nothing bad's gonna come of it. Like a student might make fun of you, but if they're laughing, it's like, okay, like we're getting on track here. Like I see a smile instead of a scowl. I see a chuckle instead of, vulgar phrases being thrown my way, so yeah.
yeah, and I also kind of resonate with the last part about being vulnerable and like making mistakes and kind of modeling that behavior or modeling that too. As I coach an inclusive basketball program, and we bring peers from that local high school and they come out volunteer, and we have a group of athletes with varying developmental disabilities. And when we're demonstrating some things, I actually shoot my shot and shoot the free throw, shoot the layups, and sometimes I do miss. But I try to model that even if you miss, you can go get the rebound and make it again. And that knowing that we are also humans and that we do make mistakes, and it is okay to fail and to make mistakes. And as teachers and promoters of physical education and physical activity, I think that last part is really important to show that that it. And also, that kind of touches back on the social emotional learning as well, which is a huge thing that we as adults also need to do a good job of demonstrating how to deal with failures and not succeeding the first time, and kind of showing that through your actions too, because kids do really remember a lot of things that we may not remember. And I still have like some students like referring me to. Like there was this one game called like Dungeons and Dragons, something along that line. And even like, Yeah, coming back like years later, it's like, oh, you're the dragon. I'm like, huh, like that was from like so many like long time ago. But we do as teachers really do have a lasting impact on that on them, and that we do need to yeah demonstrate a sense of vulnerability so that they also understand that it is okay to make mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and yeah. This question kind of came stemmed from when we were at in Hawaii for the Pac Rim conference, and a lot of the things that that really resonated with us was like the cultural responsive pedagogy and how they were trying to keep the language and the culture of Hawaii within their curriculum and within PE. So, is there any ways that you incorporate like cultural responsive pedagogy? And I know you're up in Vermont, maybe it snows and it's something that we don't get. Is there anything that you incorporate that into your lessons that students might be exposed to in their environment and in their communities?
Yeah, I think again, my school's so unique and we're a niche in what we're able to offer. And I think at my school, being able to use universal language, whether it's academic language or clinical language, behavioral language for our students, so they understand. That would I think I'm answering this question correctly. That is kind of our approach to make sure everybody's on the same page and using universal language that the kids understand, and that when another adult says it, they're like, "Oh yeah, I heard that word before. What are you talking about?" In regards to like Vermont language, not necessarily, but the snow and stuff. Yeah, like I get to take my kids outside. We go sledding. We do ice skating.
Nice.
I can dig more into that later. You did have a question about like what is one thing that's unique to me about my school. Now, I can answer that later if you want. But I think just overall, our student or our school setting, students, teachers, clinicians, et cetera, being on the same page when it comes to language and consistency with programming is how we were able to promote that culturally responsive pedagogy. Yeah.
Now, can you give some examples of language? I think like that teaching students to be self-advocates and understand kind of what's going on in their brain is super important. I know you mentioned a couple of your students might have learning disabilities, and the students that I taught at the elementary level had learning disabilities, and just kind of having them understand their amygdala and their hippocampus and how their brain worked and that it was different, I think was really helpful for them to kind of have that self-accountability. So what are some examples that you like that you can share with your students?
Yeah, so we use a term a lot for students, like if their lids flipped. So you know that
Oh.
amygdala. And so like we go like this, and it's like your lids flipped, like you're not thinking right, or you're not thinking in the way you would if you were at baseline or if you were at regulated, you know. We use terminology called like a chill. So students know there's a designated spot that they go to if they want to leave the classroom or have been directed out of the classroom. We talk about sensory breaks. We talk about boy, I don't even know what else. I use it every day, but now I'm like, what words?
Right.
Sensory breaks, regulation breaks. We advocate for students, or we try to teach them. Like you can ask for a chill. A chill does not have to be a negative thing. Like if a teacher, it's a
Yeah.
teacher chill or a break, you know, then it's like we've given you multiple reminders and like, hey, you might need some time out of the classroom versus a student recognizing that self-awareness, like, hey, I'm starting to feel a little like anxious, or I'm not sure if my lid's gonna flip soon. So I need a break. I'd like to go on a chill. And so a lot of our students, like I said, we have this reward system where they get like PAX dollars for self-awareness. We use a lot of different systems too, which is so cool. And trainings that we get to use universal language. Like,
Nice.
I would not know all this when it comes to social emotional learning or I think trauma informed care if I didn't work at this school. Something that I
Right.
think is very important that all schools, regardless of where you go as an educator, should learn. TCI, LSCI, you know, all of our, we talk about how you need to go through, it's called like an interview process. So like after a student has a behavior, We isolate the conversation, we explore their point of view, we summarize it, we talk about how we could have done things differently, we act it out, and then we say, what, how do we get you back into the classroom? What are the things you're going to show other students, or if this happens again, or teachers, that you're back in the classroom? It's like, oh, the next time I'm going to ask for a break, or I'm going to take space in the peace corner, or I'm going to X, Y, and Z.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's awesome. TCI, I think it's Therapeutic Crisis Intervention, and LSCI
Okay.
are Life Space Crisis Intervention. So trauma, a lot of trauma-informed care,
Okay.
which is awesome.
Yeah, I think more people need that kind of training and preparation just for students in general, not just that EBD population.
I 100% agree. Not even students, I think just in life, like people, you know. It's
Right.
a great skill to have out in your day. So.
For sure.
So the next question, is there any short-terms or long-term goals that you have for your students? I know we're in the middle of it all, but kind of seeing the finish line towards summer. So is there any short-term goals or long-term goals that you have set for your students or for the school as a whole?
Yeah, I think, like, I don't write IEP goals at all, which is a little different than, the traditional AP world. I just see students every day. I would say it's more specialized PE. I see students 4 days a week, 30 minutes. I differentiate, I can modify, I can adapt things as needed as they come, whether it's equipment, what we're doing that day, gameplay, etc. But my goal as a teacher at Baird School in this population specifically is to just give students the skills and tools to be able to say no when it comes to being physically active versus a student not knowing how to do something and that being the reason for no. So my goal is to ex is expose them to different sports, different skills that might transfer to sports, lifelong activities, and whatnot. So that they have the opportunity to be active outside of school if they choose. Like, it's obviously I want them to, but them to have that power and to make a choice, which is a very important thing for this population to be able to have say, or like have a say in what they do. And it be a no, I don't want to do that, not a no, I don't know how to do that. It's kind of my teaching.
Yeah. And can we pretty much assume that your students do not have a motor delay? So that's not the kind of students that you're working with.
Honestly, if I did an assessment on a student or an observation and then went to an assessment, whether it's the TGMD or whatever it is, I bet you I might have a few students
Okay.
who would be like under the standard deviation. And I talked about it when I first got here, my supervisor, what do you want to do? How can you grow? And I was like, does APE exist in the state of Vermont? And they're talking about. And I was like, okay. And then I went to a professional development because Vermont just started doing the fitness gram, actually, like five
Oh,
years ago. And so I went, and I was like, well, what about students who get AP services? Like, are we doing the Brockport? And they're like, what are you talking about? And I was like, this is a foreign concept to people. It's insane.
jeez.
Yeah, but in the state of Vermont, if you are a licensed physical education teacher, you are deemed qualified to teach APE. So therefore, you don't necessarily have to have services or pullouts, and you can implement it within your classroom setting, which is unfortunate. And it's typically we have a lot of PTs and OTs that come in and observe, at least at my school. And a lot of the times it's, yes, some gross motor movement, but fine motor stuff also. But they'll come observe because I think that's the best setting to do it. And like, yes and no. If a
Sure.
student has trouble with their dexterity, like I'm gonna watch them write in class or type and et cetera, not like the way they throw a ball. They're very different things.
Right.
So yeah.
Okay.
And we're kind of getting towards the end of the questions, but I know we touched on a little bit earlier, but what is something that is unique to you and your students at your school? that look a little bit different from even within the state or even compared to other classes?
Yeah, so I talked about all the training that we get, which is fantastic because we are a mental health institution, Howard Center. It is, I believe, the biggest mental health organization in the state of Vermont.
Wow.
And so our school falls within that. So we are provided a lot of services, whether it's outpatient services for our students or families, additional support in the community. Students get group every day. The type of training that we get too, like I said, TCI, LSCI, we just started a new one called Ukuru, which is fantastic. We have seen physical interventions and our numbers decrease dramatically since we started Ukuru, which is awesome.
Right.
I can answer that more if you have questions, but just the training that we get of de-escalation, trauma-informed care, and whatnot, I think sets our school apart. Everybody wants to understand the student and provide the best care, nurturing environment so they can learn and flourish. But sometimes people don't have the adequate training to do so, and we're a little out of our realm. Sometimes I am too. That's when I look to clinicians. But having just the basic training that I do, I think allows me to be a much better teacher on a grander scale, even if I didn't work with this population specifically. But I run this really cool program called Outdoor Challenge or Outdoor Classroom on Fridays. Since we don't have PE, I take classes out on 6-week rotations and I take them into the community and we do things like mountain biking. I've done sailing. I'm about to take a class ice skating, skiing and snowboarding. We actually work with Vermont Adaptive for skiing and snowboarding. They're awesome.
Cool.
What else do we do? Boy, rock climbing, a whole lot of things. We again expose our students to activities and stuff that might not necessarily always be accessible to them outside of the school setting, but being able to get that little taste might drive them towards a positive, fun thing to do outside of school,
Now, is that used as like a reward or it's just something that everyone gets to do?
Every Friday, everybody gets to
That's
do it.
awesome.
I'm in charge of planning, running it, which was a neat thing for me. It's so neat though. Yeah, I think being able, what did we do? A skateboarding and like a wheels unit sort of thing. So we did
Oh,
like
I know
skate.
you like to take your rollerblades out.
Do I love to rollerblade with my dog?
Yes.
We get to do very fun things, and we're very fortunate to be able to do so, which I
So you
find
probably have a lot of community partners that support that.
we do. Yep, and I'm very
Awesome.
fortunate that we have grant money to be able to do that. A lot of these activities aren't cheap, or again, like as
Right.
accessible for people in the community, and so being able to provide them this option is great. And our school in general, our Howard Center as an organization, does have a lot of connections in the community. Like Burton headquarters is here. And so we
Okay.
have students who do a chill, it's called the chill program, where they learn skiing and snowboarding and or after schools like once or twice a week for a prolonged period of time. And so our
Oh, nice.
clinicians work with community partners to set up things that students are interested in over summer or over winter. So basketball camps, soccer camps, et cetera. Gymnastics. I just finished a
So
gymnastics unit,
cool.
my K2 class.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
Academy, and it was really fun. So,
So cool.
something that I could teach. I'm not the best teacher, but we have trained professionals who are gymnasts to be able to do it. I was like, this is great. Two for one.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I love the
Very good.
community-based programs that you have, and I know that might be not accessible for everyone, but the fact that they do get a chance to be exposed to a sport or an activity that they maybe wouldn't even know that existed for them. So that is great that you are making them like lifelong learners of physical activity so that they can stay active even when they are out of the school and when they graduate from your school program. That is great. I love to hear that.
Okay, so I've got a couple more behavior management questions because,
Okay.
why not?
Charger.
So how would, okay, go ahead.
Gotta grab first.
Okay, so for behavior management, how, like, let's say we've got someone that refers a student with EBD to APE for a referral or for consultation or whatever. How would you recommend that APE teachers provide support to GPE teachers for this specific population?
Ooh, that's a great question. I don't even know if I have an answer for it, because again, I'm very fortunate to collaborate with so many people to be able to provide the support for this student. My number one piece of advice would be to get to know the student and what do they like, and understand them. And so I remember I did some contracted APE work in Texas when I was there. I didn't know the student at all. I'd just like shown up the first day. He was a little timid and I was like, "What do you like?" And he was like, "What do you mean, what do I like?" And I was like, "What do you like to do? Do you like to watch TV? Do you like to play games?" And he's like, "Oh, I really like Thomas the Train." And I was like, "That's great." And so I made Thomas the Train his target, so like being able to implement like small little personable things so the student feels like they're cared about and somebody like understands them or wants to get to know them at least. I haven't thought about it in that aspect because I'm not sure how many referrals people get for EBD students, and from a general milieu population or public schools, I guess.
Right. So it doesn't happen often, but we absolutely can provide APE services to students with behavioral needs. And so I think that the more we know about that, the more we can provide support because I think this population really could benefit from APE support and, managing behaviors.
That's a good point. I think being able to help with the behavior management aspect, not necessarily the consultation aspect for physical gross motor skills,
Right.
as an APE, like OSEP scholar and somebody who's lived in the EBD world, I think having classes on trauma-informed care especially would be a great addition to like course load. Again, I went in blind and I've learned so much and I'm very grateful for this experience, but it was like, I wonder what it would have been like if I knew these things ahead of time. Would I have felt more prepared? Would I have felt like I knew what I was doing? Probably not, because I was a first year teacher out of school. You live and you learn.
Right.
You learn what you get and such. So, but yeah,
Right.
it would be something I'd be interested in. Because every
Yeah.
student has a different story, and not slapping a label on them just because the student has trauma doesn't mean that these two students are going to show up the same or be the same, even if they have similar experiences, because everybody's body, everybody's brain, the way we function is very different.
Totally. And I think what you mentioned, that trauma-informed care, that is going to be beneficial for everyone, not just your students that have these significant behavioral needs. So I think that's really important that we have to remember this kind of universal design also relates to these kids.
Absolutely. I think there is a little bit of forgetfulness with them just because PL or the way that we look at accessibility is for, especially in special education, for students who have these observable diagnostically, assessments and stuff where students are diagnosed with X, Y, and Z, and you can see it, whether it's a limb, a physical deformity, intellectual disability, or whatnot. So.
Right. And I think that's really important for practitioners to remember that, like, these kids are not choosing to be this way. This is something that they have to live with and they've been diagnosed with. And so I think oftentimes these kiddos that have these hidden disabilities that we can't necessarily see, we've got to remind ourselves that, okay, we need to have patience. We need to understand what's happening. What are these triggers? How can we proactively work with these kiddos to, keep their best interests and their safety in mind?
Yeah, I remember my behavior management class in grad school with Dr. Dillon, I think. And it was like behavior is communication. And like as long as you
Yes.
remember that, whether it is a student who is autistic or a student with EBD, they are trying to communicate something to you, whether it's I don't understand, I don't feel safe, I don't get what's going on, something is reminding me of something where I felt unsafe, et cetera. Like they are telling you something. Whether they're able to explain that to you or not. That's the communication is the behavior aspect. So
Yeah, great point. I think that's the best way to kind of reel us all together is that
yeah.
all behavior is communication. So we definitely need to remember that when dealing with these kiddos. So I think my biggest takeaway from this is connect with your students, of course, connect, and build those relationships. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
Paul, what are your key takeaways?
Well, there was a lot of things that I really did not know, but things that as part of my grad school capstone project, maybe I should have explained this in the
Yeah.
beginning. I did make a website for behavior management to help support gen ed PE teachers, to support students with disabilities in the PE classrooms, because I thought that, like you said, behavior is a way of communication, and that PE teachers who might not be too familiar with our population kind of don't understand that. So I created a website for that. But just during this whole our conversation as a whole, thought that it is, whether it is developmental disabilities, physical or emotional disturbance or behaviors, that we behavior management, all those tactics that we learned and that we practice can be applied, like being proactive and having patience and clear communication with the interdisciplinary team, and that behavior management as a whole is universal, and that good teaching can be applied to all our populations. And yeah, that was my big takeaway, and hopefully that we'll be able to learn more for our next generation of teachers about this population, and that they will be exposed more to it in the future.
That's great. I
Yeah.
hope so too.
Awesome. Brittany, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you coming and sharing your story. And hopefully, like Paul said, everyone will take something away from this little episode and learn to be more patient, more caring, and learn how to support all of our students.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right. We'll see y'all later. Thank you.